Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, President-elect Joe Biden campaigned on the promise to return to normalcy. He also promised to return to the Iran nuclear deal. What are the complications he faces to fulfill these promises? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. President-elect Joe Biden campaigned on a promise of a return to normalcy. As part of this campaign, he proposed the U.S. return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Colloquially, this is referred to as the Iran nuclear deal, which the U.S. broke, abrogated, on May the 8th, 2018. But what complications will the U.S. face in returning to the agreement? We discuss recent developments, including the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. Our panelists are Nader Hashimi, Associate Professor and Director of Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Relations at the University of Denver. He is the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy. Joseph Cirincione, who is director of the Nonproliferation Program at the Carnegie Institute and the past president of the Plowshares Fund. Wayne Glass, professor emeritus at the University of Southern California. He was senior defense and foreign policy advisor for Senator Jeff Bingaman. And Ervand Abrahamian, who is distinguished professor at Baruch College at the City University of New York. He is the author of A History of Modern Iran. So, Professor Hashimi, we'll start with you. What are the recent developments in Iran, and what might motivate Iran to want to return to the deal?
Well, Iran's economy has effectively collapsed as a result of Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear agreement. And there seems to be no pathway forward unless the comprehensive sanctions, perhaps the worst sanctions that have been placed on any country in sort of modern history, are lifted. So I think that's fundamentally the big motivation. Of course, there are differences of opinion within Iran's ruling elite between more reformist and pragmatist forces that negotiated this agreement and very much sees Joe Biden's victory as a door that has been opened that can return Iran to the community of nations and decrease international tensions. But of course, hardliners in Iran are sort of, I think, quite upset that Donald Trump lost. They prefer to sort of play a very hard game of political back and forth with the United States, but they're very much in control of the political system. The good news, I think, with respect to recent events related to the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientists is that Iran has at least chosen, there seems to be a consensus among Iran's ruling elite that now is not the time to retaliate against Israel's ongoing, you know, assassination and bombings in Iran backed by the United States. And so there seems to be a decision to wait and see what happens when Joe Biden comes to power. But of course, the unknown here is what happens when more senior figures are assassinated. I mean, how long will Iranian restraint be able to sort of stay silent in response to these ongoing provocations? So I think that's the broad picture with respect to how the regime in Iran is sort of thinking about this particular crisis.
Professor Abrahamian, your thoughts?
You used the word Iran returned to the agreement. And this is often a term that is used if Iran will return to the agreement. Just sort of clarify, Iran never left the agreement. It was the United States that left the agreement. As far as Iran is concerned, they're there. Any enrichment they've done, they can easily undo. That's no problem. So it's a question of the perception. And the press constantly says, will Iran return to the deal? It doesn't make sense, since Iran had actually never negated or left the agreement.
That is a very good point. And yes, it was the United States that broke the agreement, and Iran actually held to the agreement until recently. So the question of whether they would return would be a response, certainly, to whether or not the United States would return, who was, you know, clearly the instigator of this. So, Joseph Cirincione, how difficult will it be for the U.S. to return? And is it possible to return just to the original agreement, or does there need to be some new provisions?
When Joe Biden becomes president of the United States on January 20th, he's going to have an inbox that is the inbox from hell. You know, so many problems to deal with, so many issues. And on the national security front, there's going to be a number confronting them, all of them extremely difficult. But of these difficult issues, Iran is the easiest to solve. And the reason is it's almost completely under U.S. control. That is, the Iran nuclear agreement is still there. It's intact, as your previous panelists have said. It's the U.S. that violated this back in 2018. And then Iran took calibrated steps to sort of exceed the limits that the deal imposed, but it never left the agreement. The inspectors are still there. Everybody else, European Union, France, Germany, Russia, China, the UN Security Council, which endorsed the deal, all that is still there. It's still intact. So all Joe Biden has to do is start complying with the agreement again, to drop basically the sanctions that Donald Trump put in place and to signal that it intends to come back into full compliance with the agreement. Saying that is easy, but as Klaus Schwartz said about war, all things in war are simple, but even the simple things are difficult. Doing that is going to require some sequencing, and not just American political sequencing. You know, how do you bring the Congress along on this? This is purely an executive branch action, but the Congress, the Senate, for example, if it's still Republican control, could try to put up roadblocks in this. But how do you synchronize this with Iran? Because what you're basically looking at is a setup where the U.S. starts to lift these sanctions, and these were put in by Donald Trump with executive order, so President Biden can take them down by executive order. But the way Biden has said, he wants to rejoin the deal if Iran returns to compliance. Well, Iran's not going to sit back and go fully comply with the deal and wait to see if America keeps its promise this time. They're going to want to go step by step. So you can imagine a situation where both countries, Iran and the U.S., in synchronized actions, start to reduce the amount of uranium enriched in the stockpiles in Iran, for example, and the U.S. starts to lift the sanctions, and they move steadily towards a date, a point, say in March or April, where they would all be in compliance. One of the factors on this is going to be the ticking political clock in Iran. Iran has got presidential elections set for the middle of 2021. The existing president, Mr. Rouhani, who made the deal, is not eligible to run again. So there's going to be a new president, likely, as your other panelists know better than I, a more hardline president. So Joe Biden's got approximately two and a half months to get this thing going, to get it basically resolved before the elections in Iran freeze any freedom of movement that President Rouhani has. And if so, if Joe Biden waits too long to do this, he may not have a deal to come back to because of what will happen in Iranian politics.
And Wayne Glass, how important is it that the U.S. return to this deal? It certainly has its critics. How essential is this sort of broadly for U.S. nonproliferation interests?
In my opinion, I think it's an incredibly important step. It's a message step. It's a, in effect, a campaign promise step. It's very clear. It's always part of the jargon in Washington. Are we better off without an agreement or without a treaty? Well, I think you could look at what's going on and think and come up with a pretty quick answer that we're not better off without the Iranian nuclear agreement, especially with respect to America's top priority security interests concerning the proliferation of nuclear materials, weapons, technology, et cetera. So we've taken a giant step backwards under the Trump administration with respect to keeping, solving the Iranian nuclear problem. So it would be in national interest, it would be clearly in the interest of President-elect Biden to send that message from the get-go that nuclear nonproliferation is once again at the top of the American foreign policy agenda. And I think meaningful steps to send that message and reestablish those lines of communication is very important. At the same time, of course, and one of the reasons that all of this has fallen apart is that those who oppose the agreement wanted the agreement to be more than it ever claimed to be in the first place. But the opposition to the agreement wants to limit the Iranian missile program and delivery programs, things like that, that weren't part of the agreement to begin with, and are much harder to negotiate. So going back to the table with Iran to resuscitate the agreement, once again, I think to me, if it's going to go anywhere, the message needs to be sent immediately, and the limitations, or rather the context in which the negotiations would take place, would again go back to our top priority security concern of controlling Iran's nuclear weapons program.
So Nader Hashemi, Iran has had an interest in developing nuclear weapons since even before the revolution. Is the deal essentially just buying time? I know there's been a lot of conversation about how the deal extended the so-called breakout time for Iran, or is there a potential that Iran's interest in developing nuclear weapons could be altered through diplomacy?
Well, you're right to point to the origins of Iran's nuclear program. It began under the Shah with sort of, you know, Western support. I suspect if there had been no revolution in Iran in 1979 and Iran had developed a nuclear program, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. We would be perfectly happy with, you know, Iran having nuclear capacity. I think the incentive from the Iranian perspective, you know, comes from different directions. One, Iran views itself as a major regional power, and it believes it should have sort of the right to have the most advanced sort of weapons as part of its, you know, arsenal for its national security doctrine. I think what's often ignored in the conversation is that there's this assumption that Iran wants nuclear weapons because it wants to drop it on Israel. And this, of course, feeds into a lot of, you know, Islamophobia, a lot of just mischaracterization. You know, I think a lot of what's motivated Iran to develop a nuclear program has really been, you know, the legacy of the eight-year war with Iraq, where it suffered a major sort of blow as a result of that invasion, and a sense that it feels sort of surrounded by hostile neighbors and by, you know, major superpower that, you know, has tried to threaten Iran's sovereignty. So there's a sense of sort of nationalism here that sort of has motivated Iran to develop a nuclear program. But I think this is the key distinction: a nuclear program with the option of trying to develop a nuclear weapon if there was ever a crisis that demanded them to do so. It's not that Iran is sort of secretly here trying to get a nuclear weapon without knowledge from the international community so it can secretly sort of, you know, start a nuclear war in the Middle East. I mean, this is sort of the thinking that you hear and the analysis that you hear on right-wing talk radio and some, you know, right-wing political analysis here in the United States. I think it's fundamentally driven by, you know, a sense of national security concerns that I think were significantly elevated. I mean, if you look at the timing of this, it was significantly elevated after 2003, when Iran found itself surrounded by a major American military presence in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And there was a sense that, look, it needs to sort of think seriously about its own national security. So I think that's fundamentally the driving point here. But it's because of the sanctions that were imposed on Iran under the Obama administration, the regime in Iran had to make a calculation, you know, whether it wanted to continue down this path and suffer heavy economic sanctions or strike a diplomatic deal with the United States that would allow it to sort of at least have some sort of face-saving, you know, program that was still sort of there in theory, but without an ability to, you know, fast track to a nuclear weapon if ever it needed to, in exchange for the relief of sanctions. And so there was a major debate in Iran, you know, on this question. The reformist pragmatist elements within the regime prevailed. You know, there was a big commitment that Iran would stick to the deal, hoping that, you know, the other parties would stick to the deal as well. But of course, as we all know, Donald Trump got elected and everything changed.
Can I just tag on to that?
Absolutely, Joseph. Yeah.
Just real quick. One, if your listeners take anything away from this program, they should take this away. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. It is not racing to get the bomb. It is not rushing to get the bomb. It is not putting together the building bricks for a nuclear weapons program. It used to have a program. As Professor Hashemi says, it was started under the Shah. It was ended by the 1979 revolution, but then kept alive and kicked back in during the Iraq-Iran agreement. But then, as our U.S. intelligence agencies say, it ended in 2003. It has not continued. So the nuclear scientist who was just assassinated, presumably by Israel, was not the head of Iran's nuclear weapons program. There is no nuclear weapons program. There is a nuclear program to enrich uranium, which Iran claims they need for fuel for their power reactor. The problem, of course, is that uranium that can be enriched to low levels for fuel can also be enriched to high levels for a bomb. So they're putting in place the ability to enrich uranium should they ever decide to pursue that, but they do not have, and this is the latest U.S. intelligence assessment, Iran does not have a program now. They're not racing. There is nothing to stop here. What we're talking about is constraining the capabilities to prevent there from being such a program in the future.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. Professor Abrahamian.
I would like to actually say it's more complicated than what was said about the program. It's clear that under the Shah, he wanted a bomb. When the revolution came, Khomeini basically rejected much of what the Shah had done. So anything that Russia wanted, he basically said was a bad idea. But towards the end of the Iraqi war, when the Iraqis started using weapons of mass destruction, especially chemical, I think then there was a decision that it was necessary to actually have some sort of protective shield, since the West actually said nothing about the chemical germs and other things that Saddam Hussein was using. In fact, the West was selling the chemical stuff to Saddam Hussein. And then to add insult to injury, United States claimed that Iran had used the chemicals on itself to get basically sympathy. It wasn't until the day after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait that U.S. came to the decision that actually Saddam Hussein had used chemicals on Iran. So the people who are running Iran, their formative years was this experience. So from that, they, I think, came to the conclusion they did need some sort of weapon to defend themselves, because if something again happened like this, they can't rely on international sympathy, into Western humanity or whatever, to help themselves, protect themselves. And of course, during the run-up to the Iraqi war, there was, of course, people on the rooftops in Washington were screaming that Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapon. So if you're sitting next to Saddam Hussein and your former enemy is supposed to have a nuclear weapon, then, of course, the rational thing to do is to start your own weapon. So I think from that period until 2003, Iran was building as a protective weaponry, a nuclear weaponry, because they had no idea that Saddam Hussein actually didn't have it. Interestingly enough, that program was stopped, and this is, everyone agrees with this, in 2003. It's not a coincidence, especially when it became clear that Saddam Hussein did not have this weapon. Iran then actually stopped its program to have a weapon. But I think what the rational decision they would have made, if I was in their position, is that you don't completely disband your nuclear programs, especially since it can be used for other things, science and so, but also for prestige. But you don't want to build a weapon because you've already signed the non-proliferation treaty. You also, it creates international complications if you have a weapon. But a very important but, if you have all the skill, all the component parts, you can, if ever there's another Saddam Hussein, and remember, on the other side was the Taliban, and the Taliban could rely on Pakistan had a nuclear weapon. If I was in their position in Tehran, I would say the reasonable policy would be you continue a nuclear program, but not a weapons program, but a program where if you need P, when if emergency comes, then you can put together a nuclear weapon. So this becomes a sort of fuzzy area where there is no actual weapons program, but there is the ability to put a weapons program if need be. And this is, of course, known as the Japanese option. And I think that's what the rational policy the Iranians would have pursued, and I suspect that's what they pursued. So that's not a direct, immediate threat. But if in future there is another Saddam Hussein, then they could basically, within a month or so, put together a weapon. And this would be a better insurance than relying on the United Nations or Western sympathy for defense. So I think the nuclear program is not a threat, but there is a nuclear program to build a bomb if necessary. I think the Obama administration was willing to live with, but others such as the Israelis may feel that they can't live with even that possibility. And that's why they want to have basically to take out Iran, to destroy the regime.
Now, Wayne Glass, I know one of the issues with the Iran program that the U.S. had was that it was officially in compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. The Iranians were always quite careful to make sure it remained in compliance, but the U.S. alleged that Iran was violating the spirit of the NPT and instead trying to find loopholes, if you will. So is the JCPOA, at least in part, viewed as a way to ensure that the nonproliferation treaty still remains viable, intact, and important to nonproliferation?
If I understood your comment here, I think that it's vital for the Biden administration to establish commitment to continue, maintain, and sustain the NPT. And therefore, any activity with respect to Iran and resuscitating the nuclear agreement is a key to that strategy. So this is a very political time. It's an uphill climb, to say the least. And as Joe was mentioning, if we only got a couple of months of window here to send a message, we need to be very careful about and quick about establishing those lines of communication, knowing that we've got our own domestic political audience to be attuned to, not to mention the domestic political audience in Iran. The Trump approach that every international problem is a nail and we need to hammer it is counterproductive, to say the least. So it's very important to change the tone, in my opinion, for the Biden administration to at least start moving in the right direction and right away as a matter of priority. Everybody's got their mind on the virus. There's so many other things going on. I mean, people aren't even thinking about nuclear proliferation as a major issue. It still is. So I think it's important for the Biden administration for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is that the nuclear proliferation, nuclear weapons, and all that goes along with it, right up at the top of the list of what keeps me awake at night, even still.
Can I just say why this agreement is so important?
Absolutely, Joseph.
You hear the criticism from Israel and Saudi Arabia and their domestic U.S. supporters that this is a flawed agreement, or as Trump would say, a terrible deal. Nonsense. I've been working on nonproliferation for 35 years in Washington. This is the strongest nonproliferation agreement I have ever seen. The only flaw in this agreement is that we didn't have pictures of what the Iranians did. We didn't have video of what the Iranians did because the Iranians didn't want their own public to see this. You have to understand what happened here. They had almost 20,000 centrifuges. They ripped out 3/4 of them. It took them months to do this. Brand new centrifuges, ripped them out. They took the core of their plutonium production reactor, pulled it out, drilled it full of holes, and filled it with concrete. They had tons, hundreds of tons of low-enriched uranium they had to ship out of the country. All this was perfectly good material. Part of this deal was that they had to shrink their program to a fraction of its original size and then freeze it for a generation. They couldn't do anything on this for 15 years, in some cases 20 years, and in some cases, for example, build a nuclear weapon forever. They could never build a nuclear weapon. That's part of the agreement. And then we put it under a microscope. We have cameras and seals and inspectors. We track, still to this day, we track the uranium in Iran from the time it comes out of the Iranian mines to all the way through the processing facility until it's stored in the warehouses. We know exactly what Iran is doing. This is the toughest inspection regime ever negotiated. You let this go, you're letting go the gold standard of nonproliferation. Did it solve all the problems we have with Iran? No, but as Wayne said, it wasn't supposed to. It solved the most serious problem, the nuclear threat. Every other issue we have with Iran gets worse if Iran gets nuclear weapons. This solved the nuclear problem. What Biden has to do is get back into it, just restore this agreement to where it was, and then use it as a foundation to build other agreements that can start to address the differences between our two countries, the differences that Iran has with other countries in the region. The threat to all this, interestingly enough, is not Iran, it's Israel. Israel clearly does not want this agreement. In Washington, Benjamin Netanyahu said, "You cannot restore the JCPOA. We cannot go back to the deal." He's dead set against it. Why? Because he doesn't want any deal with Iran. He doesn't want this regime. He wants to overthrow the regime, not legitimize it with these kinds of international agreements. And he's got Saudi Arabia and the UAE on his side. So it's going to be this dynamic that Joe Biden has to resolve, even more than the dynamic of how exactly you get back in the deal and what you should do after you restore the deal.
Yes, Nader.
Yeah, speaking of Joe Biden, what's actually quite shocking is how quiet he's been over recent events with respect to the, you know, assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist, because the attack effectively was also an attack on Joe Biden's stated plan of diplomacy with Iran. That's very much what the target was. And the fact that Joe Biden hasn't said anything, or any of his senior advisors on foreign policy haven't said anything, is very concerning. The other concern that I have with respect to Joe Biden's policy is that if you listen to some of the hawkish voices who are deeply influential right now on Iran policy in the United States, people such as Elliot Abrams, who's, you know, really a notorious figure in many ways, but he's the key sort of contact person, the key person in charge of Trump administration's policy toward Iran right now. He's sort of sending signals to the Biden administration that, hold on, there's no reason to rush and re-sign back onto this agreement because Iran is under significant economic pressure. He said explicitly in an interview that he gave with Christian Amanpour a few weeks ago that Iran cannot sustain four more years of this type of heavy economic punishment. Iran, in other words, needs the United States much more than the United States needs Iran. Time is on our side. Let's see if we can't sort of maybe push them a little bit to get them to think about including discussion of Iran's missile program, other regional issues. So if Biden is going to be persuaded by that narrative, and I suspect there are people within his foreign policy circle who are sympathetic to that view, that suggests that this is going to be dragged out a lot longer. It could overlap with what Joe mentioned earlier with Iran's presidential elections, and you'll have people coming to power who will be much, much less interested in diplomacy than President Rouhani and Javad Zarif. So this could drag out for a much longer period of time. It really depends on, I think, decisions that Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken decide to make, how quickly they want to move. And so I'm very fearful that, you know, the words of and the advice that that's coming out of the mouth of Elliot Abrams and others is going to get a receptive hearing in Washington. And if that happens, this drags this conflict out for a much longer period of time, and it opens up the possibility of a broader regional war. If Israel keeps hitting senior Iranian officials, eventually Iran is going to have to retaliate for its own national security, you know, reasons. So that's something to watch for.
Yes, Wayne Glass.
Thank you for that comment, because it raises the question of one of my favorite questions about Washington, which I call the crystal ball exercise. Having worked in Washington and the Pentagon and the State Department and the Congress, it's very clear to me that the position papers aren't written at the top level. They're written at several levels down in the bureaucracy by experts who know the area. And they bubble up and they get coordinated and they finally end up at the desk of the top person. So the question is, we know a few of the appointees in the Biden administration, but we don't yet know who are the second and third level political appointees who are going to be writing those position papers. In the case of Vice President Biden, one of his major portfolio item as vice president was nonproliferation, nuclear security. And he had a team of people that worked with him in the White House on that program. Be very interesting to see if some of those advisors will reappear at the second and third levels in the executive branch as Biden begins to put his papers together. I'm sure the transition team has already been working on these things. Joe, you might know a little bit more about that than I. But at the same time, the identity of those people, and I know a number of them, and I know the, pretty well where their mind and heart is with respect to the Iranian problem. And I take great comfort in that, actually, because this is not a matter for impulsive politics. This is a matter for people who have been there, done that, and understand the nuances of this issue. And I think from my experience with Vice President Biden's office, he's got a lot of really capable people in the wings here that can come to the table and help move the ship in the right direction. Joe, what do you think about that?
Top of the list has got to be Jake Sullivan, who's going to be the national security advisor. And remember, he started the negotiations secretly with Iran. So he knows this deal inside and out. And of course, the Secretary of State designate Anthony Blinken was deeply involved in this. And so the good news is that we have a cast of top professionals who know how to negotiate, who understand the deal, who understand the stakes. But what you have inside the Biden team is a little bit of a disagreement now between those who want to, well, basically follow our advice, get quickly back into the deal, lock it back in, and then build on it, with those who are tempted by what we might call the leverage option. And you see this being circulated by some of the hawks that Professor Hashemi noted. That is, let's use the Trump sanctions as leverage to get Iran to make greater concessions so that we can fix the deal, get a better deal, include limits on ballistic missile testing in the deal, for example. This is a complete fantasy. This totally misunderstands the U.S. position here. We're the ones who violated the deal first. We're the ones who left the deal. We're the ones who broke with our allies. You may remember back in May 2018 that we had the Germans begging with Trump not to leave. The French president came over, begged not to leave. Then Foreign Minister Boris Johnson begged. Our closest allies tried to keep us in this deal. We're the ones who left. The only leverage we can possibly get is by rejoining the agreement. That's where you get the leverage to actually be a party to the agreement again. That's where you get to actually negotiate and start bringing this up. But that debate, as you point out, Wayne and Professor Hashemi, is unresolved. The more hawkish elements of the Biden administration may be tempted by this illusion of leverage. And that is the kind of difference that Bibi Netanyahu is going to want to exploit. And he's going to keep hyping the threat, keep ginning up this myth that Iran is on the on a path of aggression, is the major problem. Mike Pompeo just tweeted out, Iran is the number one threat to peace and stability in the Middle East, completely overlooking what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen, what the UAE is doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the task for Biden, if he stays on course, if he stays true to his impulses, is to try to restore the kind of policy of equilibrium that Obama tried to put in place, where we oppose violations of human rights on the behalf of Saudi Arabia and Iran, that we have to take a more even hand here in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example. I think that's what Biden's going to want to do. We'll see if he can overcome his more hawkish advisors.
When we come back, the arms control deals that the United States has unilaterally broken. How does this complicate Joe Biden's negotiations? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United States has unilaterally broken several arms control deals. How much do these violations affect Joe Biden's efforts to return to the negotiation table? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Ervant, you had some thoughts.
Yes, I'm sure there are people who want to add other things and use the term leverage to get a better deal or whatever. But I think the people who are going to run the policy know from the Obama regime that you have to basically quickly resolve this issue, because by June, there's going to be a new administration in Iran. That's going to be a much tougher regime to deal with. So if the stark choice is that you go back to the agreement now or play around and risk a war further down the road, I think the conclusion will be very much like the Obama administration, that you better actually make a deal now when the opportunity comes. The Biden administration can always use the argument, yes, after we deal with this, go back, we can negotiate other issues. And I'm sure Iran would be willing to do that. So if they want to put limitations on missiles, I'm sure Iran would say, fine, we could agree with, but then there has to be limitations on missiles going to Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates. So these are things that would be negotiated later on. But the immediate issue is basically the non-proliferation agreement. And if that isn't resolved, things are going to get much worse, and now you have to face that. That might be all right for Israel, but people running Washington have to make the decision, who's running U.S. policy? Is it going to be Israel or is it going to be Washington? And it's clearly for Washington's national interest is to go back to the agreement that was signed by Obama.
Now, Nader, I was thinking about this question. I mean, certainly Iran's interest in returning to the deal is to get sanctions relief, the effect it's having on its economy. But broadly, the United States has demonstrated a lack of commitment to previous agreements. How much can Iran trust that even if the U.S. does in fact return to the JCPOA, that it will hold, at least at a minimum, that it's not a partisan question, so it depends on which party is in the White House, or that the U.S. is just no longer reliable when it signs arms control agreements?
With polemics, I think in Iran they could say, well, you know, you can't trust the United States because it's a strike court. But someone like Zarif is actually savvy enough about American politics. He knows there's a big difference between a Biden and a Trump. So it's not like the United States can never be trusted. It's who you're dealing with. And you can make a deal, of course, with Biden. Maybe then a Trump will return. But that's part of politics. You don't know what's going to happen in 4 years' time. But for the immediate period, it would be, of course, in Iran's interest to go back to the agreement, even if they know that U.S. on the whole is not a reliable partner.
I would just add very quickly, the question that you just posed, I think, reflects an internal debate that's taking place in Tehran right now in the following sense that, okay, Joe Biden won the election, but it was a very close election. The power of the Donald Trump narrative is very strong. And 4 years from now, another Trump or someone like him could get elected, and then we're back to where we were in 2018 when the United States withdrew from the agreement. So I think what this does, what Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement does, it actually strengthens those hardline voices in Iran who are saying, look, the United States is not a reliable partner. We could be going through these, we could see the same movie again, in other words, 4 years from now, if another Republican gets elected to the presidency. And so we have zero interest now, if ever we did to begin with, to talk about incorporating discussion of Iran's missile programs or extending the sunset clauses. You know, forget it. This is the United States has proven itself, at least, to be an unreliable partner. And so I'm hoping what Ervan has just said will prevail in Tehran. In other words, the arguments that Iran does have huge advantages by signing on to the deal. But I think the big takeaway here is that Trump's actions have emboldened hardliners in Iran. They've emboldened hardliners and extremist forces throughout the region. And I think that's going to be the big takeaway. Iran will be much less willing to compromise or to extend the conversation about other issues that have to do with its behavior in the region, because it knows that if it signs an agreement with the Biden administration, who knows what's going to happen 4 years from now and in a possible, you know, future Trump presidency.
And Wayne Glass, the U.S. certainly seems to have a credibility problem.
Obstacles, I think, contextual obstacles that the Biden administration has to face. The legacy of Trump's behavior and the legacy of American diplomatic behavior writ large. I mean, I remember being in the Senate after 9/11 when President George W. announced the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty. There was no vote in Congress. There was no discussion. There was no two-thirds vote in the Senate to ratify a treaty. It was W. who said one day, we're out of here. That's an incredibly dangerous precedent with respect to the power of our executive in our country. Whether it's a treaty or an agreement, it's pretty clear. The track record in the past 15 to 20 years has been that the president pretty much can do what he wants to do, and the Congress is not going to say much about it, certainly as it's currently composed. So this is a part of that hole that the Biden administration's got to dig ourselves out of, is it is establishing bona fides and credibility with respect to the power of President Biden to get us on track and keep us on track, in particular, if the Senate remains in the Republican majority hands.
Let me just reinforce that point. This is Joe Cirincione. You know, this is true across the board, as you said, Wade. I think Americans don't really appreciate how much our credibility and legitimacy and standing in the world has deteriorated in the last 4 years. And even before that, I was just listening to a podcast today talking about what Joe Biden can do about climate change. And they pointed out that you had Bill Clinton agree to the Kyoto Agreement and then had you had George W. Bush pull out of it. You had Barack Obama agree to the Paris Agreement and then have Donald Trump pull out of it. So there is a real problem with the rest of the world has with can you trust America? And you heard that in this context just Friday, the day we're recording this, the EU foreign minister was making the suggestion that Joe Biden would have to start relaxing sanctions first in order to build up some credibility that Iran and the Europeans could trust that the United States was really willing to come back into this agreement. In other words, we have a credibility deficit that makes other countries less willing to take promissory notes from the United States. They want to see real action before they'll take action of their own.
And so with that in mind, Ervand, how should the U.S. go forward? I mean, certainly rejoining the JCPOA, we all seem to be in agreement. This would be obviously a very positive step. But then are there other steps that the U.S. can do first to build credibility in the region and also to recognize some pretty legitimate Iranian concerns for its defense?
Very easy. I mean, the simple things such as basically making it clear to the Europeans that they can actually sell to Iran medical equipment, even simple things like flu shots. I'm not talking about the virus shots, but simple flu shots or surgical materials that can't be sold because of sanctions. The Europeans are more than happy to willing to deal with that. But the message has to be sent from Washington that Europeans are not going to be penalized if they export these things to Iran. That would be a simple message that doesn't even need a presidential order or anything. It was just making it clear that such a transactions would be not penalized. That would send a clear message to also Iran that basically this is a different type of administration. But going back to the question for the Iranians, when they're posed with the situation, you can't trust the United States, but they also have faced with the question, when you have Biden, is it not the opportunity to actually make a deal with Biden? What's the alternative? Sure, maybe a Trump will come back, but if you're not going to deal with Biden, the alternative could be very well a confrontation with the United States and Israel within the Biden administration. So from their realistic point of view, even the hardliners would prefer to deal with what they have, which is an opportunity, rather than risk some sort of confrontation in the near future.
This is Joe. I think that's an excellent point, and I don't want to get the rest of you guys in trouble, but I would say right now in this moment, I think Israel is a greater threat to peace in the Middle East than Iran is. Iran is certainly aggressive. There's a lot of things that Iran is doing that we don't agree with, we don't want them to do. I certainly don't want to live in Iran under the political system they have. But it's Israel that's pushing this issue. It's Israel that just killed an Iranian civilian, a scientist, on this. Imagine how we would, what the conversation would be having if Iran had killed an Israeli scientist. And Israel gets to get away with these things. And I believe Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to provoke a war. I don't believe this assassination is his last move in the 50 odd days that we have left before Trump leaves office. I think he wants to bring down the deal. I think he wants to try one more time to get the United States to carry out a war that he's unwilling to carry out. He wants Trump to do what he's been trying to get Trump to do for 4 years, to take military action against the Iranian regime, overthrow one way or the other that regime. This could be the most dangerous 50 days we've seen in the Trump administration. We'll be lucky if we get through them.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org.
Yeah, I would agree with Joe on that 100%. I mean, it's pretty clear that, just forget about what happened recently with respect to, you know, the Israeli sort of, you know, assassination of Iran's, you know, senior nuclear scientist. But right from the beginning, when there was discussions that the United States and Iran were in a dialogue and there was a nuclear agreement that was on the horizon, Israel sort of tried everything possible to sort of prevent the agreement from happening. I mean, even using its lobby in Washington, D.C. to do something that we've never seen before, where Benjamin Netanyahu was effectively invited by the pro-Israel lobby to speak to Congress against the wishes of the sitting president of the United States, basically a slap in the face to the Obama administration. We've never seen anything like that before. That gives you a sense of the level of hysteria and paranoia that exists within the Likud party in Israel, primarily with respect to this agreement. And I think the reasons for that, I think, haven't been fully discussed. It's not simply because, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is facing, you know, an election and he wants to sort of play to his right wing. I think fundamentally Israel wants the spotlight focused on Iran so that the spotlight will not be on what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. If there is an Iran nuclear agreement, if there is a reduction in tensions between Iran and the Western world, if there's greater trade, then people are going to look to other areas in the Middle East that are destabilizing the region, and that is the longstanding Israel-Palestine conflict. So I think that's a big motive behind Benjamin Netanyahu's destructive policies here. And it leaves me with a lot of concern that up until now, Biden and Blinken haven't said anything about the assassination outside of Tehran, because they were the direct target of that assassination, their stated policy. And it suggests that they are very, I think, interested in not upsetting Benjamin Netanyahu and not upsetting the pro-Israel lobby. They're very close to that lobby. They're very strong supporters of, you know, Israel as it's currently as it currently exists. And they're very sort of unwilling to use American leverage on Israel to do anything for the Palestinians. So that does not, I think, bode well for the future Biden administration and its ability to stand up to the machinations of Benjamin Netanyahu and his attempt to draw the United States into a broader Middle Eastern war. I think that's a huge concern, and it deserves much more discussion and attention in the mainstream foreign policy debate than it has received up until now.
Wayne Glass, your thoughts on this question?
Well, thank you for that comment, Nader, because this whole issue is not dyadic. You can't approach the issue in a void. There's so many other variables, particularly the variable of Israel and Saudi Arabia and the UAE and so forth and the region. So that if the Biden administration is going to make a move towards Iran with respect to the agreement in the coming months, that can't be a shot in the dark. It's got to be a well-developed strategy with sensitivities to the other players so that the message, whatever is sent, has some credibility. And I'm hoping that the Biden team is hard at work with these kinds of understandings, because it's very important, I think, to make that move to sort of reestablish the grounding floor for the getting re-engaged in the agreement. But it can't have any credibility if it if it falls apart on the shores of Israel and Saudi Arabia and the other regional actors that are really the moving force behind disassembling this agreement in the first place.
Actually, Wayne Glass, I have another question for you. You had pointed out that the U.S. abrogated the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, without any sort of congressional action. Could there be congressional action that might try to block or at least complicate the U.S. returning to the JCPOA, considering how significant of an issue, how emotional of an issue this is, and how partisan this issue is, in particular with the likelihood that President Biden would face a Republican Senate?
Well, I think that's a good question, Doug. If you're looking for legislation with the rule of law, probably not, because the president has to sign it. If you're looking for a sense of the Senate resolution or something of that nature, no doubt, in my mind, that they'll pull out all the plugs to make those kinds of political statements to throw a wrench in any of the Biden administration efforts to make things good again. Of course, Georgia's still hanging out there, and the potential impact of this Georgia election on questions such as these is really important. And unfortunately, the American people and American voters, I think, don't have an appreciation for the second, third, fourth degree effects of that election in Georgia this time around. The Senate can make a lot of things happen or keep a lot of things from happening. Just a comment on that. I think I was devastated, I guess, when that precedent was set in 2001 with the U.S. with the withdrawal from the ABM treaty, because I knew the downstream effects of that action. Again and again and again, can we trust working with the United States to follow through on an agreement, or can we trust the U.S. as a partner in an international treaty? After that happened, I'd love to see the Congress pick up that issue yet and reestablish the role of the Congress with respect to withdrawing from a treaty. If the Constitution says that it requires two-thirds of the Senate to ratify a treaty, what's to say that there shouldn't be something in law that the Congress should have a voice if the United States elects to withdraw from a treaty? Nothing. I'd love to see something happen on that regard.
And this is Joe Cirincione again. As Wayne points out, even if the Republicans control the Senate in 2021, they're not going to be able to pass legislation on this. But what you can expect is a number of things. One, right now, the Trumpists are trying to burn the House down. They're trying to pile on as many sanctions as possible, try to make this as difficult as possible to get the deal back. I think it's going to be hard, but I think Joe Biden can do this. Number two, you can expect that they will try to use their leverage on nominees to try to extract concessions from them to not go back to the deal or to agree to new sanctions or to agree to any one of a number of punishing provisions that could be used on Iran. But number three, I think the major attack on this is going to be political. It's going to be on the Fox News cast. It's going to be at the AIPAC conventions. Those people who want to overthrow the Iranian regime, and that's what this is really about. Either you negotiate with Iran or you overthrow it. That's the divide in Washington. They're going to be demonizing Iran as much as they ever did before. They're going to try to scare Americans into believing that the Iranians are going to come in the middle of the night and cut their throats. And they're going to try to intimidate the Biden administration. So this is going to be a real test for the Biden administration. Do you believe what you say or not? Do you really want to have a foreign policy that puts diplomacy first again or not? Are you going to stand up to these guys or not? And just one last comment for Professor Hashemi. I'm not quite as disturbed by the lack of comment from the Biden transition team as you are, because I believe the team is actually pretty old-fashioned. And the old-fashioned view is that the United States has one president at a time, and that the incoming president does not comment on foreign affairs until Inauguration Day. I know this is something that Donald Trump didn't adhere to. You remember the Flynn deals they were making with the Russians that got Flynn indicted, but traditionally that is the way you do it. So I understand what you're saying, but I'm not worried about the relative quietness of the Biden team just yet. We're not able to look for more subtle signals from them than an outright condemnation of the Israeli assassination.
Just a quick comment, Joe. I hope you're absolutely right in terms of reading the Biden administration. But of course, the old rules don't apply in the era of Donald Trump when, you know, these events that are taking place with the blessing of, you know, Trump and Pompeo are a direct attack on Biden's foreign policy. So we're really in a different landscape here that you would expect there would be, you know, this is not sort of just another transition. This is sort of, you know, a unique moment where Joe Biden and Blinken and everything that they've said about the Iran policy is directly being targeted by these assassination attempts. So that's why I'm a little bit concerned that there hasn't been, I'm hoping maybe behind the scenes, there are signals being sent. I certainly hope that's true, but the silence does concern me about what the future policy will be.
Ervin, I'll give you the last word.
Just the optimistic side, the agreement, the nuclear agreement, apparently is more popular in America now than it when it was actually signed. Also, there's an argument that the Biden administration can use is, you know, Trump put 4 years of sanctions and pressure, it didn't work. So what's the argument about not going back to diplomacy? So you'll find actually some senators, like our own Senator Schumer, who was very questioning the agreement when it was signed, they've moved much more towards a rational position of seeing actually the benefits of the agreement. So the arguments for the agreement are, I think, much stronger now than they were when they were first signed.
And we will end this on a rare optimistic note in the hope that we won't have to continue to return to this question, or if we do, we can return to the idea of the U.S. once again being a credible partner, a credible signatory and party to international negotiations. Our panelists today have been Nader Hashmi, Associate Professor and Director of Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies, the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy. Joseph Cirincione, who is the Director of the Nonproliferation Program at the Carnegie Institute and the past President of the Plowshares Fund. Wayne Glass, Professor Emeritus at the University of Southern California. He was Senior Defense and Foreign Policy Advisor for Senator Jeff Bingaman. And Ervand Abrahamian, who is Distinguished Professor at Baruch College at the City University of New York and the author of A History of Modern Iran. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.